The next case for argument is 21-1154, Celgene Corporation v. Mylan Pharmaceuticals. Good morning. Ms. Thompson, before you begin, how do you pronounce your first name?
Elodie, like melody without the M.
Interesting. Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
May it please the Court, Elodie Thompson, Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart & Sullivan, on behalf of Appellant, Celgene Corporation. I'd like to start with the dismissal of Mylan NV. The complaint against Mylan NV should be reinstated because the district court wrongly failed to accept the allegations in the complaint as true that Mylan NV...
Can we just go to the complaint? Can you point to me the specific allegations that support that Mylan NV participated in the filing of this ANDA?
The allegations in the complaint, if I could point the court to page 120 of the appendix, is that Mylan NV acted in concert with MPI and Mylan Inc. in relation to regulatory approvals.
Okay, sorry, I was getting there. Where on this page, which number?
It's paragraph 23.
Okay, but this is a very general statement. It doesn't say anything about whether they work with them on this ANDA. Why is this enough that they generally might work with them to meet the Twombly standard that they participated with them on this ANDA? Isn't that what required?
Well, first, that's not required at the pleading stage in this instance because that information would not have been known at the time the complaint was filed. Exactly what Mylan NV's role was with respect to this ANDA would be discerned in discovery. It wouldn't have necessarily been known at the time the complaint was filed, at which point you didn't know exactly who
But you didn't was. Even say that you had a good faith belief that they worked with them on this ANDA. Don't you? I mean, you can't just guess, right? You can't just say, well, these are a bunch of interrelated companies. We're going to guess that maybe they worked with them here.
Well, it's not a guess that Mylan NV worked with them. It's that the way the business model is, these are the entities that set the business strategy and secure the regulatory approval.
Is this what you've got in terms of the complaint? Anything else?
The other allegations relate to Mylan NV directing the conduct of the subsidiaries MPI and Mylan Inc. But of course, if this court has
in
any...
In this case? Or generally?
Again, no, Your Honor, not in this case, in relation to ANDAs generally. But if this court has any concern about whether the allegations here meet the pleading standard, of course, the correct result would be to reverse and remand to allow for amendment of the complaint to add those allegations.
Well, but the district court denied you that, right?
The district court did deny.
What's our standard review on that?
The standard review is for abuse of discretion. However, under Third Circuit law, the reasons that the district court relied upon are an abuse of discretion because what the district court relied upon was the passage of time.
Well, didn't the district court also rely on the fact that you had agreed that you would be bound by the renewed issues with the other two people, the other two entities as well?
That's not what the district court cited in anything related to the 2019 action here, nor, frankly, in relation to the consolidated action. The district court just said, here we are 3 years after the complaint has been filed, and you...
But venue has hotly been contested, right? And you didn't attempt to amend.
Venue has been contested, but this relates to Mylan NV as to which venue is indisputably proper. And the district court in the decision related to the 2017 motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim in the consolidated action didn't reach the question of whether there was a failure to plead sufficient allegations as to Mylan NV. So the timing issue, which is what the district court relied upon, is really as a result of the venue discovery taking so long. It took 2 years, and then there you are at the end of the venue discovery period, considering a Rule 12b6 motion 3 years after the consolidated action was filed and on year and a half after the 2019 action was
during
filed.
During this venue discovery, did you do any discovery into whether NV actively participated or did anything that would have caused venue against it to be involved here?
There was in relation to the motion, in opposition to the motion to dismiss filed in the consolidated action, a proposed amended complaint that was filed. That's at appendix pages 2830 to 2893. That includes additional allegations as to Mylan NV's role. And so, certainly when there has been no opportunity to amend a complaint, then an opportunity should be given to amend to meet the pleading standard. In addition, the request for leave to amend was before the expiration of the time at which amendment would be permitted for the 2019 action. But the reality is this was all started because instead of saying in 2017, as to Mylan NV, that doesn't relate to venue, dismissed without prejudice, you may amend the complaint, the district court instead said it's denied as moot. So the timing issues really are a result of what happened in the district court and not addressing it until 2020. But I don't think the court actually needs to reach that question because all the court needs to do is look at the decision in Valiant, in which there were almost identical allegations, and the court reversed and remanded us to the dismissal of the foreign entity there. There were, similarly as to here, all three entities were...
Well, in that case, we had to remand it. The district court had never considered that issue in Valiant, whereas here the district court considered the issue and rejected the amendment, and we're reviewing it under an abuse of discretion. So I don't think you can walk away from Valiant and say where that sort of compels or even suggests what we should do in this context.
Certainly. Well, as to the abuse of discretion standard, that does apply to the denial of leave to amend, and we think under Third Circuit law there was a clear abuse of discretion.
And in Valiant, as I'm recalling, there had never been any consideration of the other issue, and that's why we remanded. The district court had not ruled on anything related to that issue, correct?
Correct. There had been no ruling on the Rule 12b6 motion in that case from the district court, which, of course, this court reviews de novo. But in looking at the allegations in Valiant, and certainly there are other cases cited in other district courts where there are identical allegations, and there was a claim that was stated. And so even if this court says, no, you must do more at that point in time when you don't know who did what in relation to the ANDA, there should at least be an opportunity for leave to amend because Celgene had no reason to think that its allegations would be insufficient given the prior holdings. And I think that this court's decision in Valiant certainly supports that.
Speaking of Valiant, I mean, you don't try to... Are you, with respect to the other entities, are you conceding that you lose under Valiant? You seem to try to make a distinction with a Valiant in this case, but I'm not getting what the distinction is.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court is referring to distinguishing Valiant on the whether an active infringement has occurred in the district.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly is a very big distinguishing factor, which is the paragraph 4 certification that was sent to Celgene in New Jersey. In Valiant, the entities that sued the plaintiffs were located in Ireland, Japan, and Delaware, but the lawsuit was brought in New Jersey. That's not the case here, where Celgene is located in New Jersey, which means that the paragraph 4 certification, notice of which must be provided to the NDA holder and the patent holder, had to be sent to Celgene in New Jersey. So that's a clear distinguishing factor between Valiant and what happened here.
I'm just saying, even though all the ANDA preparation and everything like that took place in New in West Virginia. Let's just assume that's true. I don't know if you dispute that or not. Just sending notice that that's required to the company in its other home in another state where, let's assume Mylan has no basis at all, is enough to establish a venue in the patentee's home district?
It's enough to indicate that an act of infringement has occurred in that district. And that's because they, under the ANDA framework, the submission must include proof, not only that the notice of the paragraph 4 certification was sent to Celgene in New Jersey, but that it was received by Celgene in New Jersey.
And why is it that the submission of the ANDA under the statute necessarily includes the act of sending the notice letter to the patent owner? My understanding of the statute and the regulations is submission of an ANDA, including the certification, is completely separate from and a precursor to the ultimate transmission of the notification letter to the patent owner. Is there something in the statute or the regs that shows me that the transmission of the notification letter is a necessary act and component of submitting an ANDA to the FDA?
Yes, and it is that the ANDA application has to be amended to include proof that Celgene was notified in New Jersey. And so that
I understand that there's a rule that talks about amending the ANDA, but still there's the act of submission. The use of submission throughout the statute and regs seems to be contemplating a particular thing that is a precursor to the notification letter itself. You have to do a certification. The certification is a promise. Included in that is a promise that you will send a notification letter. But it's not, certification doesn't include proof that you actually did send the notification letter, as I understand the requirements for certification, paragraph 4 certification.
So
am I right about that?
My understanding is that under 21 CFR 314.95E, there has to be an amendment filed with the ANDA application as part of the submission. Not only that the paragraph 4 notice letter was received by Celgene, but it requires supplementation with proof of delivery, essentially.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, why isn't it that submission is different from amendment? You prepare your ANDA, you submit your ANDA, and then including the certification, and then after you submit the ANDA, you send a notification letter to the patent owner, and then you then give the FDA proof of sending that notification letter through an amendment, but that's separate and apart from the actual submission itself.
So I think the court, looking at the structure of both the statute and the regulations, can see all the parts that must be in the ANDA submission. And for it to be an act of infringement, it has to include the paragraph 4 certification. And for the 45-day clock to trigger for the filing of that infringement suit, there has to be notice provided to the patent holder, the NDA filer, and an amendment to that ANDA submission with proof that that notice has been received. And so it's because when you look at the...
To trigger the window for the patent owner to file a lawsuit, not only do you have to receive the notification letter, but the ANDA applicant also has to amend the ANDA application?
The 45 days triggers from when the notice was received, but the FDA has to receive proof as part of the ANDA submission that the applicant complied with the requirements. And that's because under the statute, the act of submitting is only infringing if it includes a paragraph 4 certification, and the 45-day clock for triggering the infringement action is related back to when the notice
was
sent.
Do you have anything other than that one regulation that calls for amending the ANDA that includes proof of documentation that you sent the notification letter that, in your view, requires us to understand a submission, quote-unquote, of an ANDA to necessarily include proof of providing notice to the patent owner?
The statute itself requires that the notice be sent. So it's the statute and the regulation.
I understand that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's part of the submission.
Well, the submission, again, if it has to be filed with the FDA, then it is submitted. And if the court is looking at a temporal aspect of it, then the FDA will require additional information in connection with an ANDA as a general matter, and it's necessary for the FDA to consider the ANDA to have all of the required materials filed. And so there's nothing that says there's only one day on which the submission is complete. Of course, if there are amendments to the submission that must be filed with the FDA, that necessarily includes them within a submission. Submit is not contrary to what Mylan has
argued.
But
isn't it all still being submitted from West Virginia? The fact that it's sent out and then ultimately received somewhere else doesn't somehow broaden where the submission is occurring, which is what we, in the ANDA cases, construe as the act of infringement. Otherwise, I guess you're just saying Congress somehow implicitly amended the venue statute in ANDA cases to allow claims to be made in the patentee's home district, even if the generic manufacturer and producer had no connection whatsoever to that.
Well, no, Your Honor.
That would be inconsistent with general patent venue rules, wouldn't it?
If I may go to, you know, and certainly it is unique, and it is unique in terms of patent venue, because really the infringement that you're looking
at. Well, it's the same venue statute though, right? It's not a different venue statute.
We have argued that Section 1391 could apply for ANDA actions.
Assume we don't buy into that.
But assuming that the court doesn't buy into that argument, yes, it is the same venue statute. And while the patent venue statute must be narrowly construed, the Hatch-Waxman Act does not need to be narrowly construed.
Well, you know, Valiant, if you look back at Valiant, I mean, there is a footnote where the court kind of acknowledges we're not purporting to resolve every single possible question about what's in the preparation of submission. But the case does say, in Hatch-Waxman cases, venue is proper only in those districts that are sufficiently related to the ANDA submission, in those districts where acts occurred that would suffice to categorize those taking them as a submitter under 271E. So I guess I'm having the same problem that it appears Judge Chen is having, establishing the connection between what you're saying is part and parcel of the submission of the ANDA. I'm just not seeing it. So you want to try again?
Sure. So the reason that the paragraph 4 certification and notice provided to the patent holder and the ANDA filer, the NDA filer, which in this case is Celgene, is part of the ANDA submission is because without that paragraph 4 certification, there is no infringement, and without notice provided to the patent holder, the NDA filer, there is no, the clock doesn't start for the infringement action. That notice provided to the patent holder says, here are the patents that are implicated. Here are the reasons why they're why they're invalid or not infringed. And that is what triggers the filing.
And that makes them, our court said was in those districts where acts occurred that would suffice to categorize those taking them as a submitter under 271E. So you think that makes them a submitter?
Well, in this instance, MPI sent the notice letter to Celgene in New Jersey. And so it's an act directed at New Jersey that MPI took in relation to the ANDA submission.
And that makes Celgene a submitter?
It doesn't make, no, Your Honor, it doesn't make Celgene a submitter, but it's an action that the submitter took, Mylan generally here, directed at New Jersey. And we do have this argument, the impari material argument, which indicates that there, when a venue statute says we look to where an act has been committed or has occurred, we look to where it's directed, where its effects will be felt. And there's no question here because we know the infringement action is directed at Celgene, or the infringement is directed at Celgene in New Jersey, because in the Orange Book patents, they're required to list who the patent holder is, the NDA filer, and the address at which the representative can be contacted to provide the paragraph 4 notification.
So you're not saying that the Celgene was the submitter?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. We're way out of time, so we'll restore some rebuttal, and let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The District Court in this case issued a detailed 43-page opinion dismissing all three entities at issue in this case, two for lack of venue and one for failure to state a claim. That detailed opinion set forth precisely the evidence of record regarding venue and the pleading allegations regarding failure to state a claim that warrant dismissal. That decision should be affirmed. To start with the first question that I heard from Your Honor, regarding what specifically in the complaint are they standing on, and it's paragraph 23 on appendix 120. What I heard was that, yes, this allegation is nonspecific, problem number one. What I didn't hear was it's also conclusory. That's problem number two. What my friend on the other side said was that this allegation was not a guess. Well, if it's not a guess, then where are the facts that back up that they actually worked in concert together?
Well, what about the court's dismissal of this and her not allowing them to amend?
So that was in the first case. And so this appeals from the second case, so I'm going to start in the first case. So by stipulation, it's the record and the resolution from the first case that applies in the second case. In the first case, they didn't file a motion, that was pointed out by the district court, they requested leave to amend in their opposition brief. And in doing so, they made that request 2 years after the court deadline to file an amended pleading or to file a motion to request an amended pleading. And we were also a handful of months away from trial at that point. The district court said that they're well past their deadline and that ship on amendment has long since sailed because of it. The district court also pointed out that the same complaints that we had regarding the sufficiency of their complaint were filed in 2017. They were on notice of our problems with the sufficiency of their complaint. If you compare our first motion and our second motion, they're virtually the same when it comes to 12b6 because the complaint hadn't changed. So they had plenty of time before the court deadline to file an amended pleading. They chose not to. Rather, they chose to file this request, which again was not a motion, only in opposition to the motion that we renewed later in 2020. So the court properly denied them leave to amend. Now, the stipulation that was agreed to by the parties says that the final resolution of the first case applies fully to the second case. So that resolution, by stipulation, applies to the second case. That's what they stipulated to. That's why, in force and effect, they were denied leave to amend in the second case.
In resolving the 12b6, it appears that the district court relied on some discovery for venue purposes in making the decision.
I respectfully would disagree with that, Your Honor. What we did in our motions, we submitted documents that were integral to the complaint. In other words, an excerpt from the ANDA and the notice letter itself. Those documents were integral to the complaint because they were referred to expressly in the allegations of the complaint. Under Third Circuit law, I believe it's the Burlington Coat case, it says you can do that. A movement under 12b6 is entitled to do that because the plaintiff has notice of those documents because they're specifically referred to in the complaint. So the district court correctly considered those documents in connection with a Rule 12b6 motion. Celgene does not dispute that point, and dismissed the allegation that this group allegation that Mylan submitted, the ANDA, the group allegation being Mylan was a short form for three separate entities, dismissed that group allegation as to Mylan NV because those documents show that MPI and MPI alone submitted the ANDA.
In a theoretical world, I know, you know, it might not be possible under what we know under the facts of this case, but what could and should have Celgene done to get over a 12b6 motion with this complaint with respect to Mylan NV?
Your Honor, with regard to Mylan NV, there's nothing they could do. And that's because we actually submitted affidavits on this that the court did not consider in connection with the 12b6, but in connection with the venue, rather, because it was also a live issue in the venue portion of the motion, that Milan NV had nothing to do with the preparation of the ANDA, nothing to do with the submission of the ANDA, nothing to do with the eventual future distribution or sale of the ANDA. So there is nothing they could do.
But in a hypothetical world where they might have had something to do, what would they have done? They would have asked for venue discovery and more promptly moved to amend the complaint?
It wouldn't
if
have
they
been.
Had found out evidence that showed the foreign entity had participated in it factually somehow.
So strictly speaking, it wouldn't be venue because we're talking about 12b6 here, but some sort of general discovery regarding who did what in connection with the ANDA. And indeed, that's what the parties did do for 3 years leading up to our renewed motion. So they had plenty of opportunity to find that evidence, and nothing that they found rebutted the affidavit that we submitted along for the venue portion that said Milan NV was not connected to the ANDA in terms of its preparation, submission, or any future plans for it.
Can I just ask a side question related to the evidence, which is just that there's a lot of stuff marked confidential in the briefs and in the appendix, and it's not intuitively obvious to me why some of that stuff is confidential. And that includes some of it's about Milan employees and what they were doing in New Jersey. And there's a lot of other stuff that's very general information about Milan's corporate structure. Do you know what I'm talking about? And is that stuff necessarily I mean, we've got to write an opinion in this case, presumably. Do you adhere to those confidentiality markings here, or are you prepared to disavow them?
So with respect to Milan employees, because we're talking about their residences, we were very concerned about employee confidential information. That their residences are their personal homes. As you can see from the briefing,
okay,
they have nothing
so
to do with Milan.
So you're talking about addresses and names of employees.
That's
now.
Correct.
Okay,
that's correct.
Fair
so
enough.
Things like their some of their web pages from LinkedIn, whatever else, those are all public. We don't have a problem with those. But specific to their residences, we were concerned about that. And if we stepped too far, Your Honor, I apologize for that, but we were just trying to maintain their confidence.
And what about Milan's corporate structure?
Milan's corporate structure, is there a specific reference, Your Honor?
No, I don't have one.
Okay. I will say generally, I think the concern is that the information had to do with, a lot of the discovery requests had to do with financial information regarding these entities and how they interrelate to each other. And so we were concerned because none of that stuff is public. And frankly, the disclosure of financial information that is not public is something that my client is sensitive
okay.
about.
Let me move you to, I think, maybe where you were going, which was the second portion of
correct.
The discussion here about what acts are related to submission under Valiant and whether the acts that your friend here described were sufficiently related to submission.
Sure. And so I believe the only activity that my friend pointed out was the submission. I apologize, the sending of the paragraph or notice letter to Celgene. And I want to respond to Judge Chen's question, which had to do with, is it actually part of 271E2? And it's not. A cause of action under 271E2 is complete upon submission of the ANDA. The notice
right.
letter.
And the other side's argument is you don't have a complete submission of an ANDA until you amend the ANDA with proof of sending the notice letter.
So it is required under the Hatch-Waxman statute that you tell the FDA that you complied with the statute by sending notice. It is not part of 271E2. And the example I'll raise is that when you send a notice letter to the brand, before they sue you, they don't ask you, oh, did you let the FDA know about the notice letter? And that's because the cause of action for infringement under 271E2 is complete upon the submission of the ANDA. Whatever is sent regarding the notice letter, confirmation, whatever else, that's not part of a complete act of infringement. As Your Honor pointed out, it is the submission. It's electronically submitted, so when the button is pushed, that is the act of infringement.
But the ANDA applicant has to amend the application under FDA's rules to include proof of sending the notification letter.
Confirmation must be provided to the FDA regarding the sending of the notice letter.
Yeah, through an amendment of the submission. Which then raises a question of, well, then when is the submission truly complete? We know the requirement, apparently, is to do this kind of amendment. So is that amendment part of the submission, or does it come completely after the submission? That's really the question I'm trying to figure out.
In the context of 271E2, it comes, in terms of the timeline, it's after the submission. It is something that occurs after the submission.
Because why? If the FDA rules require the ANDA applicant to amend its ANDA application.
Because the cause of action of infringement is complete upon submission of that original ANDA. We can be sued immediately, right then and there. There's no need for this extra step of, please let us know that you confirmed the FDA the notice letter received. And another point on...
I thought their time for filing a suit is triggered upon receipt of the notification letter.
Of the notification letter, not of the submission of the paperwork to the FDA regarding confirmation that the notice letter was sent. And a point on the notice letter, the theory here is that the sending of a notice letter to an address in New Jersey somehow makes New Jersey relevant to the submission itself. We think that turns 1400B on its head, because what they're saying is that an office building operated by the plaintiff is relevant to the venue statute. But the venue statute is quite specific. It's focused on defendants and defendants only, their place of incorporation, where they committed acts of infringement, where they have regular and established places of business. It is not focused on the plaintiff at all. So this argument is legally incorrect because it reads language into the statute that's not there, or it broadly construes that language, which is not consistent with Supreme Court instruction, that the venue statute is to be narrowly construed. Unless there are any further questions, I will see the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Thompson? We'll restore 3 minutes of rebuttal.
I'll start with the amendment of the claim as to Mylan NV. And first, I want to say that my friend on the other side was incorrect that the trial was imminent. On appendix page 48, incorrect that trial was imminent. On page 48 of the appendix, the court denies Celgene's opposition argument that the improper venue motion was forfeited because it wasn't brought in a timely manner. And it does so in part because it says no trial is imminent. It's incongruous to say this motion for improper venue isn't too late, but it's too late to amend a complaint as to Mylan NV, which the court won't address until we address the improper venue motion. But I would also just point out that under the abuse of discretion standard, since this court applies Third Circuit law, the court should look to Alvin versus Suzuki, which is 839 F3rd 242. It's a 2016 decision. It says that a denial of a leave to amend based on a case management, relevance of case management order is an abuse of discretion. That's what happened here. That's the reason that the motion for leave to amend was denied, and that's an abuse of discretion. Finally, while we think that the arguments related to the 12D summary judgment motion are entirely improper, I did want to pick up on your questions, Judge Prost, concerning the information under seal and the length of discovery, of venue discovery. If the court would look to pages 2401 to 2405 of the appendix, they will see that it took 2 years nearly for Mylan to reveal its corporate structure and the overlap between officers and directors. And as the court pointed out, that information is under seal now. And while that's not relevant to assessing a Rule 12b6 motion, I do think that it's relevant to this court's consideration of what additional facts Celgene could have pleaded at the time it filed the complaint. Because all of that information about the interactions between the Mylan entities, Mylan keeps very closely guarded. I will turn very briefly to the act of infringement. One, in deciding the act of infringement that occurred here, that's under the Hatch-Waxman Act. And so there's no constraint to narrowly construe the Hatch-Waxman Act. Then the act of infringement should really comport with the purpose of the Hatch-Waxman Act. This court in Valiant said that acts of infringement are those sufficiently related to the ANDA submission. So it's not when was the button pressed to submit, but what is sufficiently related to that submission. And here the notice letter sent to Celgene in New Jersey is sufficiently related to the ANDA submission. Unless the panel has further questions.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning. Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning. It's 10:00 a.m.